Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
I think I'm going to share with you a couple of rather odd little pieces of news or a couple of odd little stories that I've come across in the last few days. One of them actually is several weeks old that I meant to refer to earlier, but for one reason or another, I just haven't gotten around to it. This is from Politico.com a couple of days ago. It's about the congressional candidacy of Dan Quayle's 33-year-old son, Ben Quayle. The younger Quayle has made a bit of a splash in Arizona politics. He's in a congressional primary, I believe it's the 24th of this month. And he's cut a commercial in which he's looking at the camera with what I think he intended to be sort of an intimidating gunfighter-like expression. Bear in mind, this is running in Arizona once again, in which he talks about Barack Obama being the worst president in American history. He might eventually become the worst president in American history. Right now, he's certainly on that trajectory, but he's got a way to go yet. He's frankly got a way to go, in my opinion, to match the accomplishments of his predecessor in terms of wrecking the economy, destroying what remains of the Constitution, and so forth. But he's doing his level best to maintain seamless continuity with his predecessor. And if you want to talk about better candidates for the title of worst president in American history, it's sort of hard to beat Lincoln. I mean, 600,000 Americans dying on your watch is a pretty good definition of failure, I'd think, by any rational metric. And if you translate that into contemporary terms, I think you'd be dealing with something in the order of 3 or 4 million Americans dying. So, as far as I'm concerned, Lincoln's at the top of that list, or the bottom, depending upon your perspective. Anyhow, Ben Quayle cut this commercial where he's trying to come off all gangsta, talking about his need to go back to Washington. Somebody has to go back to Washington and knock the hell out of that place, is what he said. One of the least plausible tough guy acts I've ever seen, quite frankly. I mean, Al Gore was almost that implausible back when he was trying to become alpha male Gore back in 2000. He'd have a hard time establishing himself to be alpha at a male hairdresser's convention, as far as I'm concerned. So he was around, I think, Al Gore, in order to provoke, eventually, a more charitable assessment of Ben Quayle's bona fides as a tough guy. This is from Politico. The headline, Quayle's bump on road to Congress. Republican congressional candidate Ben Quayle's glossy campaign photos and polished talking points paint for voters a portrait of a longtime Arizonan, accomplished attorney, and family man who will bring a new generation to Washington. The claims reflect the small biographical exaggerations that often accompany a political newcomer's first campaign. The reality is that Quayle has held 3 jobs in 4 years, posed for pictures in campaign literature with children who were not his, and grew up in Washington with a famous father, former Vice President Dan Quayle, whose influential friends have given generously to the younger Quayle's campaign. That last little element is very important, I think, because it illustrates the way that our elite is largely hereditary and completely incestuous. They're promoting him as a fraternal favor to Dan Quayle for services rendered. But Quayle, 33, has had to confront a much bigger credibility issue this week after a blogger revealed that he had once been a contributing writer for Dirty Scottsdale, a raunchy, sex-themed website that covered the club scene in his adopted hometown before morphing into the national gossip site TheDirty.com. At first, Quayle denied the claim, telling Politico on Tuesday that he was, quote, not involved in the site. But hours later, after blogs, news websites, and other media picked up the story, Quayle told several Phoenix TV stations that he had posted on the site, quote, to try to drive some traffic. He continued to maintain, however, that he did not post under the pseudonym Brock Landers, the name of a porn star in the 1997 flick Boogie Nights. I'll have to take that identification on faith, I guess. All this has derailed the carefully managed political debut of an indisputably attractive candidate with a name that resonates in the conservative Southwest and who seemed well on his way to retracing his father's steps to Congress. Quayle's connection to the site has undercut the carefully honed image of a conservative with strong family values, and his inept handling of its disclosure brings up a different association with the Quayle name, his father's gaffe-prone history. Quayle said the accusations are just the latest in a string of smears. No, they're not smears. As it turns out, these criticisms are rooted in indisputable fact. If it's factual, it isn't a smear. It may be unpleasant. It might be irrelevant, but it's not a smear if it's factual. Truth being a perfect defense here against libel or slander or other forms of defamation, these things are not smears. But much of the damage has been self-inflicted. In the mailer that became a campaign issue, Quayle was pictured with two young girls whom the campaign later identified as his nieces. He appeared on the back of the flyer with his wife, Tiffany Crane Quayle, whom he married in April. Oh, for heaven's sake, that's like something out of an episode of Frasier. Tiffany Crane Quayle? Yeah, that's a name that is just redolent of hard-living Midwestern values. Honestly, Tiffany Crane Quayle sounds like sort of a peripheral female second-tier antagonist from Caddyshack. That sounds like the name of somebody who would take inconsolable offense over the antics of Rodney Dangerfield's character. Sounds like one of the stuffy, supercilious, stuffed shirt folks who was part of the yacht club. Tiffany Crane Quayle. I don't know anything about her. It's just that the name strikes me as being almost insufferably elitist. Tiffany and I live in this district, and we are going to raise our family here, he states in the mailer. The couple has no children, so I guess they went and borrowed a couple. Oh, my word. His opponents pounced on what they said was a blatant piece of image creation. Well, duh. It's like a Hollywood scene that they are trying to portray, said Vernon Parker, the former Paradise Valley mayor, who served in both the George H.W. and George W. Bush administrations, and is one of Quayle's nine opponents in the August 24th primary. Other opponents have made an issue of the money he has raised, two-thirds of which came from outside Arizona, especially the contributions from friends of his father, who was first elected to Congress from Indiana at age 29 and later served in the Senate. In the 6 months since he launched his campaign, Quayle has raked in more than $1.1 million in donations. In 6 months, that's pretty impressive, including thousands from cabinet members and heavyweights from the first Bush administration. Former President George H.W. Bush and his wife, Barbara, hosted a fundraiser for Quayle in May at their Houston home. Among his opponents, businessman Steve Moak comes closest in fundraising with $823,000 raised by mid-July, including $300,000 of his own money. None of the other candidates have cracked the $300,000 mark. So what we're dealing with here is basically a two-man race between a businessman who's putting his own money where his political ambitions lie and the spawn of a career politician's loins who is being funded by the power elite. George Bush isn't going to do a fundraiser for us. Bob Dole isn't going to do a fundraiser for us, said former state Senator Jim Waring, an ex-John McCain staffer and one of three state lawmakers who resigned to run the GOP primary for the House seat vacated by retiring Republican Representative John Shadegg. Having a father who is a recent vice president and adept at fundraising helps. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Then, of course, Dan Quayle went on Fox News and blurted that his son was running for Congress before the disclosure was supposed to be made. That's yet another gaffe to add to Dan Quayle's long and rather variegated collection. Quayle is quick to use his political pedigree as a credential. I believe that my experience in the private sector and also my past experience being around Washington, knowing how Washington works, knowing how to get things done and avoid the pitfalls that some people fall into there, believing that echo chamber that is Washington, D.C., that background is unique and will serve me well as a congressman, he said. Quayle's knowing how Washington works sales pitch is jarring in a toxic Arizona political environment driven by heated rhetoric over illegal immigration and in a race that otherwise drew attention when one of his opponents, former state senator Pamela Gorman, ran a web ad featuring her shooting a variety of firearms with her hair blowing in the wind. Well, I'm all in favor of people shooting firearms, whether or not they have hair that's blowing in the wind, but really what you have here in the case of Dan Quayle is somebody who wants a congressional seat and his daddy's trying to buy one for him. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Liberty News Radio Network.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Like a scene from a Western movie, the two top lawmen here are settling their scores in public. This, by the way, is a story datelined Pahrump, Nevada. This is from the July 6th Wall Street Journal. This story has got, in other words, a few weeks behind it, but it is so weird and so typical, I think, of what we can expect to see. I take this as a portent, a harbinger, an augury of what we're going to see as the system breaks down. That I wanted to share it with you. The headline is, High Noon in Pahrump, Nevada, Sheriff Arrests the District Attorney. In May, a Nye County Sheriff's deputy arrested the District Attorney. The sheriff, Tony DeMayo, alleges that the DA, Robert Beckett, was misusing public funds. According to Mr. DeMayo, public money had gone to supporting the local cheerleading squad, led by the DA's wife, and to make a family friend's car payments. No charges have been filed, in part because Mr. Beckett, the DA, refuses to charge himself. Meanwhile, Mr. Beckett appointed a special prosecutor to investigate possible abuses of power by the sheriff's office and other public officials. Mr. Bennett claims that arresting him was part of an effort to sabotage his reelection. Mr. Beckett ended up running last among five candidates in the Republican primary. The special prosecutor filed felony charges against the sheriff's deputy, David Borukowitz, who had arrested the DA. Mr. Borukowitz was also the sheriff's informal press liaison, and after he was summoned to lock himself in the corrugated metal county jail, he sent out a press release with his own mugshot announcing he had been arrested. A judge later rejected the charges, contending Mr. Beckett didn't have the power to appoint a special prosecutor. So Mr. Beckett refiled the charges himself. Nye County occupies a vast stretch of desert twice the size of New Hampshire that runs the California border up through the middle of Nevada. Most of the county is so desolate that for years the military conducted atomic testing here. That, by the way, might explain some of the irrational behavior. Its sparse local economy includes a gold mine and a dairy farm, as well as seven brothels, legal in parts of Nevada, whose fees finance the county's ambulance services. But in the past two decades, the county's largest town, Pahrump, 45 minutes from Las Vegas, I've been through there, by the way, nearly quadrupled in population to nearly 40,000, and the local government struggled to keep up with the proliferation of houses and mini-malls strewn across the desert. Mr. DeMayo, the sheriff, and Mr. Beckett, the DA, haven't gotten along in years. Mr. DeMayo complains that his department arrests people who never get prosecuted. Mr. Beckett contends that some of the sheriff's cases aren't solid. I've often said they need a mother to stop the fighting, said Mr. Beckett's wife, Jody Beckett. It's like two little boys. The public row has already derailed much of the county's criminal justice system. The cases against Mr. Beckett and Mr. Borukowitz, got bogged down because nearly all of the other legal figures had some connection to the two suspects. The district court's two sitting county judges both recused themselves, as did a justice of the peace. The state attorney general couldn't get involved because one of its lawyers is running for district attorney. On June 20th, the Nevada Supreme Court shipped a judge from a town several hundred miles away to appoint a special prosecutor to review the cases against Mr. Beckett and Mr. Borukowitz. Defense attorneys have seized on the rift between the DA and the sheriff. One defense attorney representing a murder suspect wrote in a legal filing, quote, "A review of the internet reveals that Nye County is the laughingstock of the known universe." Oh, boy. Public officials in Nye County have frequently been accused of misconduct. A look back at the year 2009 by the local newspaper, the Pahrump Valley Times, found two bribery cases, the arrest of a former county commissioner for alleged securities fraud, and attempts to recall public officials. When Mr. Beckett ran for re-election this year, his political baggage was already weighing him down. 2 years earlier, he came under public scrutiny after flipping two cars in a single day, including one owned by the county. He pleaded guilty to misdemeanor reckless driving. Friends begged him not to run. "I tried to explain to everyone what happened," he says. "Next thing you know, they want your head on the wall." Later, the county decided to conduct an audit of the DA's bad checks unit. State law allows these units to work out payment plans rather than charge people with a crime. Mr. Beckett's bad checks unit was well known in the county. The DA can collect fees of up to 10% of the check's value that can be used for administrative costs and to establish programs to deter bad check writing or to assist crime victims. The law governing bad checks specifies the money is to be deposited in a county treasury, but Mr. Beckett says he got permission from the county to keep the money in a separate account. Uh-oh. Bank of America was a lot more convenient, and they have a branch at Albertson's supermarket near the office that doesn't charge fees, Mr. Beckett explained. The sheriff maintains that was illegal. Well, it's at very least improper. Mr. Beckett says he used the account as a kind of Santa Claus fund for the junior rodeo or the softball team. People would come to us and say, "Bob, we're broke. The kids have no programs they can participate in." I said, "Well, okay, maybe I can sponsor your program, but you have to give us something back." In return, he would often get to display a banner promoting his program to deter bad checks, he says. Mr. Beckett says that aggressive marketing made it more effective. He contends that it was legal to spend the money that way. The sheriff says the fund spent about $6,000 on the cheerleading squad run by Mrs. Beckett, among many other uses that sheriff deemed illegal. Once again, it's at the very least inappropriate. You really shouldn't be using public funds for some private purpose that is going to have a material benefit for somebody in your household. This seems to be pretty obvious, at least obvious to everybody but the Becketts here. Mr. Beckett contends he gave to various community programs and did not favor family members, except, of course, for his wife, the most important family member. The county officials say that when they wanted to audit the fund, Mr. Beckett stalled. That's always a bad thing. On April 21st, Mr. Beckett missed a meeting with the auditor. Later that day, Mr. Borukowitz obtained a warrant to search the DA's office located just down the hall from the sheriff. 2 weeks later, Mr. Borukowitz arrested Mr. Beckett. The special prosecutor is now tasked with sorting out all the conflicting legal claims that have drawn in most of the major public figures in the county. Chief Deputy District Attorney Kirk Vito, actually it's Vito, said he's concerned the sideshow will take over the circus. Now, on this particular issue, you've got a really good example of a principle that is little understood but very important. To the extent that we're going to be afflicted with a government, we should have local government, locally accountable government. In the Anglo-Saxon common law tradition, the apex law enforcement officer, and it's not really a matter of law enforcement, it's actually a matter of using law to protect individual rights. The apex official responsible for carrying that out that function is the sheriff. I mean, the sheriff is the guy who has the delegated authority to protect the life, liberty, and property of people within a given county. This is something that goes back into the tenebrous mists of pre-American British antiquity. Way back before Runnymede, before Magna Carta, you had shireves, people who were the rulers of the shire. Some of them, as anybody acquainted with the Robin Hood legend would understand, were bad people. But they were supposed to be within the shire or the county to use a broadly analogous unit here in American geography, they were supposed to be the chief official in charge of administering the law. So when you have a situation here where the district attorney, an officer of the court who's supposed to be a prosecutor, is plausibly suspected of embezzling from funds that are supposed to be used for public purposes, the sheriff has the right and the duty to do what apparently was done here. And now you have the whole county political architecture starting to disintegrate. This is an interesting story. I think I'm going to look into it a little bit more deeply and tell you what I find. Will Grigg with you, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397, here on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Here's another story I mentioned, I believe, last week, but I want to go back and revisit it and flesh out some details here. This is from the Houston Chronicle from August 3rd. As a prisoner, former U.S. District Judge Samuel B. Kent has been shunted into solitary confinement, forced to hear the screams of another inmate being raped, and ordered by a cruel sergeant in the Florida prison system to do calisthenics in the nude, according to allegations in a federal court memorandum filed Tuesday. Kent has requested that his 33-month sentence be vacated and adjusted based on his allegations of inhumane and unfair treatment. The former Galveston-based federal judge was impeached by Congress and resigned in June 2009 after being convicted of obstruction of justice. He admitted in a related plea deal that he lied about having repeated unwelcome sexual contact with two female court employees. In legal action this week, Kent argues that he has been unjustly labeled a sex offender by the Federal Bureau of Prisons and wrongly excluded from a substance abuse treatment program that could have reduced his sentence by as much as a year. The court filings argue that U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson, a senior judge from Florida, also believed Kent would be treated more fairly and would qualify for the program at the time of the sentencing. Instead, Kent says he has been transferred from prison to prison without explanation, at times prevented from communicating his whereabouts with his wife or his attorney, and forced to spend long stints in solitary, once for 43 consecutive days. He is now assigned to an unnamed maximum security facility in the Florida State Prison System, where the alleged mistreatment only worsened. Kent's attorney, Dick DeGaren, I believe, represented, as I mentioned before, the Branch Davidians, or at least some of them. The BOP inmate website doesn't disclose Kent's current location. DeGaren likened Kent's treatment to torture. Attorneys for both of Kent's victims had no immediate comment on the judge's request for reconsideration of his sentence. In the criminal prosecution and in congressional testimony, Kent was accused of repeatedly groping his former case manager both on and under her clothing, and once attempting to force her to perform a sex act I'm not going to describe. He also was accused of forcing caresses on his secretary and of performing various anatomically specific sex acts that were non-consensual that I will not further specify. In court papers, Kent alleges his mistreatment as a prisoner began in June 2009, the very day he resigned as a judge. At that time, Kent was assigned to the Devon Federal Prison, a medical evaluation facility in the U.S. Bureau of Prison System in Massachusetts. Kent resigned days after becoming the 14th judge in U.S. history to be impeached by a vote of the U.S. House of Representatives. The resignation allowed him to avoid removal from the bench through a full U.S. Senate trial. By the way, the Founding Fathers expected that impeachment would be much more frequent than it has been. Impeachment not only of executive branch officials, but impeachment of judges. They really thought that we would avail ourselves much more frequently of that form of exceptional accountability. What has become an exceptional form of accountability shouldn't be exceptional. It should be really, in some ways, as commonplace as voting. I'm of the opinion that every president who takes the oath of office should be impeached no later than the second week of his term. And this should be hanging over his head like the proverbial sword of Damocles, because impeachment doesn't result in somebody being removed from office. It's conviction that results in somebody being removed from office. And so I think the presumption is that every president who takes the oath of office has just committed perjury, because they have no intention of preserving, protecting, and defending the Constitution. So they should be impeached on that basis. And then at their first act of conscious violation of the Constitution, they should be convicted and removed from office. And we should just keep mowing down office holders in that fashion until we find somebody who takes that oath seriously. Kent resigned days after becoming the 14th judge in U.S. history to be impeached. That day, Bureau of Prison staff locked Kent, wearing only a smock and carrying only a single sheet, in a filthy, completely empty cell where the temperature was kept at 60 degrees. The only bed in the room was a raised concrete slab with no mattress, and the light was kept on constantly, Kent's motion to vacate the sentence says. After being evaluated at Devon, Kent had expected to be transferred to a facility where he could receive treatment for alcohol abuse and depression, the documents say. Instead, he ended up at the Lake Bear Reception Center in Florida's Department of Corrections. There, an unidentified sergeant forced Kent to, quote, strip naked and perform a painful and repetitive series of humiliating exercises. I'm guessing he had him doing deep knee bends. Once Sam Kent was too tired and in too much pain to perform the exercises anymore, the sergeant confiscated Sam Kent's wedding ring and used it to ridicule him, the records say, and I find that entirely plausible. Kent spent the next 16 days in solitary, where he claims the first night he helplessly listened to the continuous screams of a man being violently raped in the next cell, and was horrified to observe that the guards ignored the man's screams and only came to remove the man from the cell after the attack had finally ended. Kent has participated in alcohol treatment in the Florida State Prison, court papers say, but such abusive psychological and physical conditions that have jeopardized his ongoing recovery from severe depression and alcoholism. DeGuerin said Kent decided to appeal to the federal courts for relief, and other informal complaints brought no real improvement. DeGuerin said Tuesday he hopes Judge Vincent will grant a hearing to review evidence to support Kent's motion for the reconsideration of his sentence. Now, I don't doubt for a second that he's having a very bad time of it, because our prison system is utterly abominable. And abuses of the sort he describes are very commonplace, particularly when you're dealing with somebody who's been convicted of a sex-related offense or somebody who's been forced to plead guilty to the same. It takes very little to end up being saddled with the sex offender designation. Once that happens, you're pretty much stuck for life. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what recourse you may have in terms of overturning the sentence, or what evidence you adduce to demonstrate that you were innocent. At some point, if you've been designated a sex offender, permanent damage will be done to you. I don't know a whole lot about Kent's history. I've been trying to find what I can about his performance as a federal district judge and his career up to that point. I don't doubt for a second that this guy has sent innocent people to prison, or that he has sent people to prison with needlessly long and vindictive sentences. There is a certain, although I don't believe in the religion that generated this expression, I believe that it's appropriate to the discussion, there's a certain karmic symmetry at work here, because this guy was a bully. I mean, he treated his female employees abominably. He sexually abused female employees who had no recourse against him until somebody was willing to look into what happened and hold this guy accountable and get him to admit that he had been molesting and abusing these women. But that wasn't the only way that he was a bully. Here's an excerpt from an opinion that he wrote in a case called Bradshaw versus Unity Marine Corporation. Before proceeding further, the court notes that this case involves two extremely likable lawyers who have together delivered some of the most amateurish pleadings ever to cross the hallowed causeway into Galveston, an effort which leads the court to surmise but one plausible explanation. Both attorneys have obviously entered into a secret pact, complete with hats, handshakes, and cryptic words, to draft their pleadings entirely in crayon on the backsides of gravy-stained paper placemats in the hope that the court would be so charmed by their childlike efforts that their utter dearth of legal authorities in the briefing would go unnoticed. Whatever actually occurred, the court is now faced with the daunting task of deciphering their submissions. With Big Chief tablet readied, thick black pencil in hand, and a devil-may-care laugh in the face of death, life on the razor's edge sense of exhilaration, the court begins. And then he proceeds to ridicule these attorneys and their pleading at length. Concluding, the court commends plaintiff for his vastly improved choice of crayon. Brick red is much easier on the eyes than goldenrod, and it stands out much better amidst the mustard splotched about the plaintiff's briefing. But at the end of the day, even if you put a calico dress on it and call it Florence, a pig is still a pig. Now, Judge Kent was notorious for defiling with dicta of that sort his rulings. He would go out of his way to be indulgently nasty, sarcastic, and condescending to attorneys who are representing contending sides in the civil proceedings over which Judge Kent presided. And he became a favorite of some people who were involved in teaching legal theory and other courses in applied law because he was so caustic. But that caustic wit, of course, was a symptom of his bullying personality, and now he's on the receiving end of it, and he doesn't like it very much. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397, and we'll be right back. What on earth is it about the judicial system in Texas? Texas is a beautiful state. I love visiting the state, as the tourism ads from about 15 or 20 years ago would put it. It's like a whole nother country. Indeed, Texas was a whole nother country for a very large chunk of time back in the 19th century. It was an independent republic. I wouldn't be at all offended if it became an independent republic again. I'd certainly trade with Texas. They got a lot of stuff that I really enjoy. For instance, I enjoy Texas barbecue. I enjoy Texas baseball. I enjoy Texas blues. Anybody who's ever been to Austin, Texas, can understand the allure of Austin-style southwestern blues. Now, a lot of my favorite guitar players have connections to Austin, Texas. Eric Johnson, some of you might be familiar with him. A wonderful guitar player from Austin, and he's just typical, I think, of the players who spring up in that milieu. One of the things about Texas I am less enchanted with, however, is the judicial system, and there is a certain really nasty, punitive nature to law enforcement and law and order punishment, penology, as practiced in the state of Texas. And here's a really good example of that. I mentioned Judge Kent earlier. He was in Galveston, which, by the way, is the title of a beautiful song by Jimmy Webb that was performed by Glenn Campbell. And we were talking about music. I really, really, really like Glenn Campbell. I particularly like the Jimmy Webb compositions. I think when his songwriting partnership with Jimmy Webb disintegrated, and I don't know when that was, probably the late 60s, early 70s, I think that was pretty much the end of Glenn Campbell's career, although True Grit might have had something to do with that, but I digress. This is from Thursday's New York Times. The headline is "Cleared and Pondering the Value of 27 Years." Since a judge let him out of prison for a rape that prosecutors now say he did not commit, Michael A. Green has had trouble sleeping. Late at night, he walks the neat, quiet sidewalks in the Houston neighborhood where he is staying with an aunt, chain-smoking cigarettes, his mind spinning furiously with questions about why he was convicted 27 years ago and how to spend what is left of his life. He also ponders, he says, whether to take a $2.2 million compensation payment from the state of Texas or file a civil lawsuit in the hope of exposing the truth about the investigation that led to his incarceration. To receive the compensation, he must waive the right to sue. Think about that for a second. Just for a second. They should be paying him anyway. They stole 27 years out of his life. Flat out stole it. Life stealing is a form of murder on the installment plan. Go back and take a look at the book of Deuteronomy or the book of Leviticus, for that matter, where it talks about man stealing. If you steal time from somebody, you're stealing increments of the one thing that we have that is most precious, which is life. They stole 27 years from this guy. They should be paying him anyway. But it's an either-or proposition. You either take the $2 million or you pursue justice. It's a bribe, in other words. What I really need to do is to make them pay for what they've done to me, he says. $2.2 million is nothing when it comes to 27 years of my life, which I spent with mental torture and physical abuse. Mr. Green, 45, was set free by a state judge 2 weeks ago after DNA tests on the rape victim's clothing proved that he could not have been responsible for the rape. His exoneration was the work of a new unit in the Harris County District Attorney's Office dedicated to reviewing claims of innocence. By the way, I don't remember the name of the Harris County DA, and I don't have the time right now to look it up. But he was featured on a 60 Minutes program a couple of years ago. I was really impressed with him. He's the one district attorney in the country who is actually going back and reviewing the thick case file, which was compiled by his predecessor. Can't remember the guy's first name, but his last name was Roe. Or no, forgive me, no, not Roe. His last name was Wade. And he is the Wade, as in Roe versus Wade. He was the county district attorney of record in that abortion decision, which Norma McCorvey, the aforementioned Roe, came to regret. She actually changed her mind. She had a change of heart and mind on the abortion, and she became a pro-life activist. But Henry Wade, that's the name of the fellow. But Henry Wade was one of these convicted all costs, and I would say demonic prosecutors, who sent hundreds of people to prison under circumstances that do not pass rudimentary scrutiny. And now the Harris County District Attorney there in Texas is doing what he can to try to rectify, there's that word again, and this is the good use of that expression, these grotesque injustices. And Michael Green is one of the people who finally have been released from prison after serving decades for crimes that they didn't commit. The story of Mr. Green's nightmarish imprisonment and how prosecutor Alicia O'Neill eventually unearthed biological evidence that led to the real culprits throws a harsh spotlight on an uncomfortable reality in American justice. The identification of a suspect in a lineup or an array of photos is not always reliable. More than three-quarters of the 258 people exonerated by DNA tests in the last decade were convicted on the strength of eyewitness identification, according to the Innocence Project, the Manhattan-based organization dedicated to freeing innocent prisoners. They are doing God's work, in my opinion. In Texas, the problem is even more acute. Identifications by eyewitnesses played a pivotal role in 80% of the 40 people who have been exonerated with DNA evidence. Some states, among them North Carolina and Ohio, have passed legislation changing the way lineups are conducted to reduce the possibility of an error. But similar bills in dozens of other states, including Texas, have failed in the face of stiff opposition from prosecutors and law enforcement agencies, defense lawyers say. In 1983, Mr. Green was a high school dropout who slept very late every day, played video games at an arcade in the afternoons, and stole cars at night to make money. Life was one big party, he recalled. He was walking home on April 18, 1983, the night a white woman was abducted and raped in his neighborhood by four black men in a stolen Camaro. He was one of several young men stopped by the police, but the victim could not identify him. A week later, however, he was arrested after stealing a car and smashing it up. Detectives showed the victim Mr. Green's mugshot along with several other photos, and she said he might be one of her attackers. Later the same day, she picked him out of a lineup of five men. And that's predictable because she'd been exposed to his photograph before. He looked familiar. He heard her scream from behind the mirrored glass when it was his turn to step forward in the lineup. He began cursing and yelling at the police. I got so mad because I recognized it was a setup, he said. Then one of the police said, I don't know what you were mad about. I didn't rape her. You did. Mr. Green spit in the officer's face, the first of many defiant acts. Good for him, by the way. No, he shouldn't be stealing cars. He shouldn't have been wasting his life. But I like defiance in the face of the abuse of supposed authority. A few days later, he turned down an offer from a prosecutor to plead guilty and serve 5 years for the rape, Mr. Green said. He recalls the trial as a surreal experience. It was the victim's word against his. On the stand, she pointed him out again. He told the jury he was innocent, but they did not believe him. At 18 years old, he was sentenced to 75 years. In prison, he fought nearly every day with other inmates at the Ferguson unit in Midway, where he earned the nickname Two Gun for his boxing skills. That's impressive. He was filled with rage, he said, and fought often with the guards, too, earning vicious reprisals. In 1985, he was placed in a segregated unit for unruly and dangerous prisoners, mostly gang members. I was considered one of the bad boys, he said. In 1986, a white inmate tried to stab him but wounded a guard instead. Mr. Green said that the attacker, who belonged to a white supremacist gang, had wanted to kill him because he had allegedly raped a white woman. Confined alone in a cell for all but 2 hours a day, he would ruminate endlessly about his trial, he said. I lay back and thought over and over and over again, why did they find me guilty, he said. In the late 1980s, he began to request books from the law library looking for a way to overturn the conviction. But he lost every appeal, and a public defender told him in 1988 that his case was hopeless, given the vehemence of the victim's testimony. By the way, a victim is not a victim in this context. You're talking about an accuser, and the word of an accuser should not be sufficient to bring about conviction. Once again, let's talk about the biblical principle. By the word of two or more witnesses will every truth be established. That doesn't mean that two or more witnesses can't fabricate an accusation and falsify testimony. That's what we talked about in the first segment, with these police officers conspiring to conceal what happened on the streets of Denver few months ago. What that means is that if you have one witness making an accusation, you have an accusation. You don't have evidence. You have to corroborate the evidence. You have to corroborate, rather, the accusation with evidence. But on the strength of this one witness, who is also the accuser, this guy was sent to prison for 75 years. And if it hadn't been for the Innocence Project and a surprisingly principled Harris County prosecuting attorney, and the advent of DNA testing technology, this guy would still be in prison, or he might be dead. But now he's being offered the choice. He can take $2.2 million as a bribe to shut him up, or he can seek justice, when actually he should be able to pick what's behind door number three. He should get the money and the right to challenge what was done to him, to pursue justice though the heavens fall. But that's not how things are done in Texas. Quite frankly, that's not how things are done in this supposedly free country anywhere. And that's because the system is designed to protect the powerful and the corrupt at the expense of the innocent and powerless. And on that note, I leave you for a week. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. Join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate the blog. Be advised that there is a PayPal button there for those who have the means and interest in donating. I'd sure appreciate it. Help me keep that website up and running. And as always, Dum Spiro Pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.